Hello and welcome to the Oldie podcast with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie, and I'm very pleased to be interviewing Anne Robinson, an Oldie contributor, the presenter of Countdown and The Weakest Link, famously known as the Queen of Mean. Do you mind that nickname?
No, not at all. I never, when I was asked to do The Weakest Link, it was a fax came through, and my then manager said, there's some effing quiz show they want you to do on BBC Two, I'll tell them you're too busy. And I said, no, let's take the meeting. And the letter, which I framed, said, she looks as if she'll know the answers to the questions, and she can ease the disappointment of the contestants when they leave the podium. So that's how it started, but I had no practice of being nice. And when we finally had a rehearsal with real live people, I realised how competitive they were. I said, why are you voting off Janet? And this guy said, who had Jesus sandals and quite bad BO. And he said, and then we had cardboard names, names on cardboard. He said, because if you don't know the names of the Teletubbies, you shouldn't be here. And I thought, oh, great, we can all be ourselves.
Oh, yes. But I first met you, in fact, briefly trying to prepare questions for you on The Weakest Link, but you didn't need any help from me because you're extremely good at being rude in an entertaining way. We had one woman on who said, I've just started at Open University, and you said, have you just got divorced? And she looked absolutely astonished. You didn't know that. But so it came naturally to you, those teasing, rude witticisms.
Well, Harry, like you, I had spent years in a newspaper newsroom, where that's the common banter, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I think secretly, your terrible secret is you're actually very kind, but would you not admit to that?
Well, I don't mind. I mean, I've always thought the contestants would feel shortchanged if I'd been nice. And the other thing is that when it came back, they asked me to do it again. I don't think you should ever go backwards, but I couldn't have said to somebody what you do when you're not eating. Things like there was a care worker from Wales whose job was to bathe very elderly people. And I said, why don't you put them in a van, let the windows down and go through a car wash? Now, you'd just never be able to say
that.
Do
you think it's changed that much? You couldn't
I do.
Say, really?
I think half of it would be stamped out.
And a lot of it comes from just telling the truth. So you and I were sitting next to each other at the late Alexander Chancellor, the great former editor of the Oldie, at his funeral. And there are a lot of old upper-class ladies with strange hair. Do you remember what you said?
Oh, yeah. I don't remember what I said.
You said something like, why do all these old posh women all have hair with grey hair scraped to one side in a big hair clip?
Yeah, that's true.
And I look round, and it's true, at this very sad funeral. Church was full of posh ladies with exactly this. So it's seeing something and saying it, and that's also being a good journalist, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's all. I've always been the most underqualified person in any job I've done in television, because they're all, you know, to get into the BBC in those days, probably now, you've got to have been to Oxbridge and goodness knows what, but a lot of them were quite stupid, actually.
Yes, and it's the same with, what would you say, famously Nick Tomlin said about journalists, they should have rat-like cunning.
Yeah.
What would you say are the crucial qualifications for a journalist and or somebody on telly? Not that different.
Speed of thought, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I would say that apart from Clarkson and I, who had been journalists in newspapers, and Stephen Glover of the Daily Mail described us as presenters, not journalists, and both of us were affronted because we reckon we never came up the ladder which told us to be careful.
How interesting. And actually, Jeremy Clarkson recently said he's very grateful to his days on, I think, the Doncaster Evening News, where he was having to write 1,000 pieces about a cat going missing in Doncaster.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah,
training.
Make it interesting. And also, that the old thing that the Sun reporters could move to the Times, but the Times reporters couldn't do what the Sun reporters do.
Could never do a brilliant headline, could they?
No, or a very short piece.
Yeah. You were very good at writing headlines, were you, in your...
Not particularly. You know, I never... It was never... there's an old expression, I didn't know my M's, so when I became number two on the Mail, the Mirror, I really didn't know anything about production. And the men, no one had ever got to that position, and there was a features editor, a Liverpudlian, and he was so... disgusted that somebody like me had risen to this height. He brought in the dummy, which you bring in about 2 o'clock of the next day's papers, with the ads all in it, and I didn't notice the crossword was missing. So the first time I ever edited the Daily Mirror, there was no crossword,
oh, really?
Which of course, you know,
yeah.
is sacrilege, because people don't care about the news stories, they care about the furniture, which the crossword is one.
Yeah. And you also, as part of your training, had quite a lot of what you might say Me Too treatment of a story of somebody dropping a piece of paper on the floor.
Well, yeah, I mean, I didn't know it was Me Too.
Yeah.
I thought, if very early on the Daily Mail, I think I was 22, you'd take your copy over because the story was needed, and we were all on typewriters in those days, and the chief sub would hold it very high in the air and drop it, and you'd have to pick it up so that all the back bench could see your knickers. And I remember thinking, well, I'm brighter than any of these lot. I will soon be in charge. So I never, ever got upset by it.
And so you didn't mind it, and do you think it's gone too far the other way now with old men being prosecuted for things they did 20 years ago?
Are you telling me I think that happened?
No, I'm asking.
Oh, okay. What do I think? I think that it has created... a team of women who are victims, and if you start protesting, you lose your pace on climbing up to a better job, don't you? You have a reputation. I'm just a pragmatist, but I grew up in a household where my mother was the breadwinner, and I didn't know. Well, she thought most men were stupid, so I never really. Either got upset or took it too seriously when they behaved in a silly way. Really.
And it's the same with it, isn't it, with asking for pay rises. In fact, that brief time I worked with you on The Weakest Link, you were very good with women there saying you've got to ask for more.
Yeah,
they're bad at
asking. You know, all these degrees they've got. There needs to be a course post-university for 6 months where they learn how to handle themselves in the workplace, and they don't go rushing crying to the loo. You know, if a woman is offered a certain salary by two guys the other side of the desk, she says thank you very much, and they go out and do high fives.
Yeah, yeah. And
that
also
hasn't changed.
And actually, although I dislike them, I'm quite grateful for the horrible bosses I've had in journalism, because you begin to realise it's not your fault, they're just like that, and you do get tougher, don't you?
Yeah. I'm not sure I've ever really had any horrible bosses,
oh, yeah.
but maybe because I didn't take them very seriously. When I was hired at the Mirror, and it was still the days when the more elderly journalists had been pushed up to count paperclips, and they'd probably done national service or even had a good war, and I'd negotiated with the editor that I'd have a car. So I went up to sign all the papers with a managing editor, an old guy, and he said, what do you need a car for? So I said, well, we're not starting negotiations now. What on earth are you bringing this up? And he said, there's no need to get stroppy.
But you did. Did you not negotiate a pay rise from the most difficult man of all, from Robert Maxwell? Was that right?
Easy. He'd had two elder sisters, and he quite liked clever, sharp women. And he just liked me, and... I let it be known that I'd had an offer to be a columnist on The Sun. I told the political editor, who was a terrible gas bag, so I knew it wouldn't take long, and he called me up, and he said, I'll double your salary. And I said, fine, but I need a nice Mercedes-Benz car. So he said, very well, and he rang Transport, and they said, well, it'll have to be custom arranged, you know, it'll be nine. No, she must have this car immediately. And then he went off to America, and 48 hours later, he rang my home number and said, Bob here, I've found you a grey Mercedes with lighter grey upholstery. Will that do?
And he turned out to be this monstrous crook, but you actually liked him, is that right?
Well, I don't think he was worse than anyone else, and he just amused me. I think everyone should have written, instead of going around telling each other in the pub that he was nicking from the pension fund, they should have done something about it.
It was known about, was it?
Well, I don't, it wasn't known in it that it was proven, but it was known, that's how they felt, because he'd put a lot of non-entities, like the number three on the picture desk, on whatever board or tribe were looking after the pension fund. So nobody questioned him. I mean, he hired the Royal Train, and he got bored after 3 days, but we had a load of the writers on, and we'd go to town halls and have a meeting. But he'd walk around Cardiff. I remember walking around Cardiff with him, with some flunky from the council, and he'd say to people, tell me what needs improving here. And then he'd say to the flunky, write that down, they need more waste bins. Or the, you know, he was just a joke, really, a really funny joke.
So you weren't at all surprised when it came out that he looted the pension fund?
No.
And on another front, you have a significant birthday in September. Are you dreading it?
No, I'm not. I'm quite surprised by it. I mean, I didn't think my generation would ever be old, actually. And 80 is huge, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't feel very old. I'm quite fit.
Yeah. And you don't look anything like that. What tips would you give to those women with scrunchy hair at Alexander's funeral?
Well, the point about the women, the posh women with the untidy hair bunched in a clip is they couldn't really give a shit, could they?
No.
So I mean, they're quite happy looking at how they do.
But what would you do? What are the basic things you do to them to make them look at least 30 years younger?
Well, I suppose I'd dress them better.
Yeah.
They might have a facelift. I had a facelift in 2004 and wrote about it. And, I mean, for ages afterwards, years, men would come up to me and have a serious conversation. Then at the end said, my wife wanted to know if I could ask you.
Oh, yes.
And I remember whoever Gordon Brown's female sidekick, I'll think of her name in a minute, and she had a very serious conversation with me about inheritance tax at a party. And just at the end, could I ask you, who did your face? How much did your face cost?
And you didn't, that came out in the papers a lot. You didn't mind that at all coming out in the papers, no?
I wrote about it, that's how it came out. No. Well, it's terribly unfair, isn't it, to wonder why I look like I look and you're the same age as me.
Yeah.
It's a good piece of journalism, I thought. That's all I've ever thought about anything.
Yeah, well, that's a brilliant approach to life, isn't it? You know, break your leg. There's 1,000 words in the Daily Mail, you know.
I think it was helpful when I got to be semi-famous that I knew what the other side. I remember a male showbiz news editor ringing me up, and he said, could I ring him back? And he was in his car, and he said, I'm driving at the moment. So I said, well, pull in. What do you want? So he said, I'm sorry to have to ask you this, but have you got cancer? And I said, not as far as I know. So he said, well, we've got it on very good authority that you've got cancer. So I said, right. Well, can you tell me who told you I had cancer? And he said, no, we can't reveal our sources. So I said, well, we're a bit of an impasse here. You know I've got cancer and I don't know about it. And this went on for a bit, and he said, all right then, you didn't turn up at Jeremy Clarkson's birthday party. And I said, I'm just going to get my medical dictionary to see if, to see if that is one of the signs.
Classic symptom. Yeah. But also that's the other good thing about being a journalist, isn't it, that you don't mind being asked anything, and also you don't mind asking anybody anything. And they can always say, no, I prefer not to answer
it. Yeah, well, it's quite refreshing, isn't it?
Yeah. And most people are happy to answer those questions.
Well, the good thing is that as a journalist, if you ask them, even though the PR's told you you can't cover it, they find it quite difficult to say no.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And to go back to your childhood, you often quote your mother, who did run a chicken stall, that's correct?
Well, no, she turned a chicken stall into a huge wholesale business. So she was supplying all the ships and the railways and the hotels.
Right.
But she always kept the chicken stall.
Right.
And we used to have to come home from boarding school, and we'd have to do 2 weeks with white coats on selling chickens. And then we'd go up the 6 weeks at the Carlton Hotel in Cannes, so it was quite schizophrenic, really. But she also insisted that we never talked about ourselves and that the customers were royalty and they shouldn't know where we went to school or anything.
And so it was quite a rich childhood, was it?
Well, it was sort of new money, you know,
yeah.
In and out drive, lots of cars,
yeah.
Mink coats, holidays in the south of France.
Yeah.
And we really wanted to be in Aberystwyth, where everybody else from Brundle Sands was, but there you go.
But she, you do quote her, or is it your aunt you quote, who has just the sixth sense for who's going to win the next election or whatever might happen?
Well, I tell you what it was. My mother would say about October, turkeys are going to be on the floor or turkeys are going to be sky high. And she was never wrong. And I do think there is an instinct that you learn in journalism or whatever job you're in, that you somehow, you know things that other people don't know because you've been at it that long.
Yeah. And also blessed with intelligence and common sense as well.
Yeah, but yes, it's a sort of radar, I think.
Yeah.
And I think good journalists have a radar.
Yeah.
That which made the Weakest Link so easy, because you could just look at somebody and, you know, ask them if they had an extension and a patio and a conservatory, and how much did the conservatory cost.
And the best journalists are also very... curious is why...
Nosy.
Yeah, they're nosy.
Yeah.
But
I
that's
mean, I've
why
just earned a living being nosy.
Yeah, it's wonderful, isn't it? And would you say more of your friends are really from journalism than from TV, aren't they?
Oh, I haven't got any showbiz friends at all. I don't think I know anyone famous.
Well, you must know a lot of them, but they're just very different, aren't they? They're not curious. And
when I was doing Points of View, because it came on after Dallas, which was 10 to 9 on a Wednesday, so if you'd watched Dallas and you wanted to hear the news at 9 o'clock, then you got me in the middle. So I got more famous than I deserved. And I went to Glasgow and I was flying there and I got in my seat and Ernie Wise came from the back of the plane to say hello. And I thought, gosh, there's a mafia of the famous.
Yes, yeah. But they are not as entertaining, very people as entertaining as journalists either. The best ones are curious and they know a lot, don't they? And
yes.
They're funny and cynical.
Criminal barristers, I think,
yeah.
Are quite high up my list.
Yeah,
they're the ones who smoke and drink.
Yeah,
did you know that? If you think about it, you know, barristers who do tax aren't our sort of people.
No, it's true. I had a disastrous career as a libel barrister, and that applies.
Did you?
Yeah. Well, I did the training. Yeah, but yeah. It's certainly true. And your father was a teacher, is that right?
He was a trained teacher, and he'd been to university and. He gave up teaching, which he was very good at in that sort of Mr. Chips way. He'd get the class of the redundant and he'd teach them maths by giving them betting slips and that sort of... and he'd teach music by playing on commercials on the pianos, that sort of teach. Anyway, came into the business and my mother would say despairingly, he's not learnt anything in 40 years because he just liked people to like him and he was very funny.
Yeah. But given he's a teacher and you are obviously very clever, why didn't you...
I don't know that I'm very clever.
You are very
clever. I've got no measuring stick.
Well, you must do this by comparing yourself with other people, realising how very stupid a lot of other people are.
Well, Harry, you once went to my local quiz and everyone heard you. We won, of course, because there was you and Mike Malloy, the ex-editor of The Mirror, and Matthew Norman. And somehow we won the quiz. And you were heard saying, I never got invited again. They're very stupid people here. There are at least two tables of QCs.
Yes, didn't know anything.
No, I know.
But then, do you mind that you brought it up? And do you mind, you must come across a million people who are stupider than you, who did go to university. Do you mind that or not? You don't feel one down because I know some...
No. You know, some clever people are very stupid, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah, and know nothing.
And you wouldn't get them to run your bath, you know.
No. And what was the spark towards going into journalism? Did your mother encourage you to?
No. I just thought I could write, and I wanted to be famous. I mean, it's very low level, my ambitions. You know, I'm sort of rich suburban childhood. You just want something more interesting. and that was always my goal.
And you realised early on you had the knack. This, it's true, the story about you discovering Brian Epstein's death, is that true?
No, what happened was Brian Epstein, well, we didn't know how he died, but he was in Belgravia in his house and he was dead when they looked at him the next morning. It was an August bank holiday, and the Daily Mail had given me a shift to see if I was any good. And we're all standing outside the house waiting for something to happen. It came to lunchtime, and all the others were men, and they said, "Now you stay here and watch while we go to the pub." And during that hour, the family solicitor from Liverpool came out, and I knew him, or my parents knew him, and he couldn't get a cab, so I said, "Get in my car, and I'll take you to Euston Station." And he gave me all the details, so I had what's called a splash the next day.
It was
a bit of luck,
yeah.
A bit of luck, and probably my natural instinct to completely ignore what I've been told to do by people who had no right to tell me to do it.
Yeah, and you realised early on in your journalistic career that you had the knack. It is a sort of knack, isn't it? That people either have it or they don't.
I don't know that I knew I had a knack. I just knew that I didn't find it very difficult.
You're right. Yeah, if you can do it, is relatively easy, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah.
If you can't do it, you can never do it.
Yeah, no, and we do. I think people who aren't journalists probably think we're rather pompous and self-regarding.
They talk about ourselves the whole time.
But we find it quite interesting.
And you married the late editor of the Times, Charlie Wilson. And is it true you got sacked because you?
Yeah, I did. I did. I was a new reporter on the Daily Mail, and he was deputy news editor. And we went off on honeymoon, and I think Harmsworth, I don't know who owned the Mirror then, I don't know who owned the Mail 2 Harmsworths ago, I think, sent us a congratulatory telegram. And then we got back, and apparently the editor, whose wife had been sacked from the Express when he became editor of the Express, said, "Why is she still here? We don't have a husband and wife." So I was asked to leave, but they said, "It's all right. We've arranged for you to see the diary editor of the Evening News." And I said to Charlie, "But I'm not a diary person. I'm much better than that." Anyway, I went to see... He said, I think Charlie said quite plainly, "Don't mess with my career. Go and see the diary editor." So I went, and he clearly hadn't got the memo which said you must hire this girl. And he said, "Have you done any diary work?" And I said, "No, of course not." And he said, "I don't think you'd be suitable. I think you're absolutely right," I said. And I went off and joined the Sunday Times. But even then, you see, the Sunday Times wanted one girl reporter, and they gave a trial to 10 of us. 9 had been to university. And I hadn't, but I'd been doing the job.
Yeah.
So when it came
yeah.
to the choice, they gave it to me. Yeah.
What was the reason for the not having husband and wives? The idea that somebody might be giving another person a leg up?
I did all sorts of traditions. I mean, when I joined the Sunday Times, you couldn't wear trousers as a woman in the office. There was no maternity leave. I mean, even Radio 2 in the early 90s, when I presented my Saturday morning show, you couldn't play 2 women singers back to back.
Amazing. And until recently, the Daily Mail had strict rules of dress for women appearing in photographs, didn't they?
Did they?
Yeah. That if you were a good girl, you had to dress beautifully. But if you were sort of scoundrel, then you could wear... You're allowed to wear black, I think.
Right, I didn't know
but
that.
But I think that's gone.
Yeah.
And you've written very movingly in your memoir, Memoirs of an Unfit Mother, about your drink problem. Where do you think that sprouted from?
Well, I think when you finally realise you've got a drink problem and you have to do something about it, I don't think you spend much time wondering how it got there. But I think Irish peasants, you know, I'm from a long line of sort of Irish Catholic alcoholic wolves. And there's a great history of drink throughout, so who knows? But considering I had a childhood with a mother who drank, was a binge drinker, it is astonishing that you find yourself in the same place, and Charlie was furious with me for being unfaithful and fought for custody, and he won it. I think he won it because the judge decided I was more ambitious than he was. Now, I should have lost it because my drinking was bad, but it meant for Emma's early years she was with him, and that was quite hard to overcome, actually, until she made her own decision.
Because I've seen you together, you're very close now, but what she decided to get closer, how did it work?
Well, I think what happened was, by the time I was standing up straight and sober, it would have been up to Emma where she lived, and I just couldn't put her through that, so it just had to happen gradually, really. And Charlie, you know, was always 24/7 editor, wherever he was. He was a workaholic. So once I was fit and well, it was quite unfair. Really.
I see, yeah, I see,
every
yeah,
other weekend
yeah.
and half the holidays. But it was a tough, you know, it was really tough.
Would you describe it very movingly in your book? I mean, did you go down something like 6 stone or something?
Oh, probably. I think they gave me 6 weeks to live. And of course, in those days, there wasn't much publicised help. You know, nowadays, there's all sorts of, you know, you can hardly see a television programme without a note at the end telling you if you need help. And it's got over the top. But I didn't have that. And it took me a bit of time to rearrange my ideas.
And it was being catastrophically unwell that was finally, as the case you have it, hitting rock bottom.
Yeah,
we can't go on like this.
Yeah.
And also, Fleet Street was swimming in a sea of booze. My dad, Ferdinand Mount, the writer, describes his first day's work on the Daily Sketch in the 60s, and they started off drinking at 11 in the morning with the editor, a couple of gin and tonics, a pint of Guinness to soothe the stomach, and then
very
a couple
funny.
Of bottles
it's
of wine.
One of the funniest chapters in one of the funniest books, your father's book, Cold Cream, because he had, you know, he had no idea about drinking. He was a posh boy with a very good degree. And of course, he had no stomach or head for that kind of drinking. He had to write the leader in the evening.
But astonishing, that would go on sort of at 11 and then a little bit of light work in the afternoon, then back to the pub.
But somehow we produced fantastic newspapers.
Yeah. Well, I caught the end of that at the Daily Telegraph with the very good ones who drank a lot. I'm not saying the drinking is good, but it meant people were chatting to each other a lot, didn't it?
Yeah, and women, I mean, people have often said to me, well, it's no surprise you've got a drink problem working in Fleet Street, but in fact, I would have had a drink problem, you know, being a nun. I think I had, you know, I just didn't drink well ever.
Right, yeah, yeah. And you gave up Countdown recently. Was that just you'd had enough of Countdown or had enough?
Well, I took it on because I thought it'd be quite fun, but I didn't really calculate I'd have to do, although they told me it's nobody's fault, 5 shows a day, 3 days on the trot in Salford. So it was always Sunday night having to go up to Manchester and stay in a hotel, and I just felt after you. Oh, I know what happened also. The lawyers at ITV or Channel 4 said you have to go on the staff. You have to go on the payroll. And I remember saying, you know, that I came from this Irish alcoholic tribe and we didn't go on payrolls, we nicked them. It wasn't the only reason, but it was confirmation I'd made the right decision. It was very great fun, actually, doing it.
Because they refused to let you work unless you were on the payroll, is that right?
Yeah.
I see, yeah.
But I'd already decided to jack it in. And I don't think I'd also realised that the journalism behind it meant I had to do quite a lot of work in finding guests that weren't Northern newsreaders.
You'd had to find the guests, would you?
Well, if I wanted guests of the quality,
right.
I'm ever having people to stay at my barn in the Cotswolds as a deal, that if they came and stayed for the weekend, would they go up to Salford for virtually no money?
Yes.
and do six shows. Was it five or six? Six a day.
Because it is, I remember the brief time working with you on The Weakest Link, it's incredibly hard work. You did, how many did you shows a day?
Well, we did three Weakest Links a day. They took 2.5 hours each because you had to come off after every round and do the calculations and work out who was still there and who was going off and refresh. They had to have a drink or be stopped feeling so tearful or whatever they had to be helped with. So it was 2.5, and you had to move the camera. I mean, none of which the viewers needed to know, but it happened. So you'd done a lot of standing by the end of a day at Pinewood.
Yeah, no, it looked exhausting. I must ask you, there have been rumours about a man in your life. Are they true?
I won't comment on any of my private life.
Fair enough. But you've got to ask, haven't you?
Yes, got to ask. Yeah, yeah. And I can tell you to mind your own business.
Yeah, exactly. Fair enough. And my last question, do you think the papers today are worse or better than...
Oh, they're very disappointing. I mean, nobody really has an investigative arm. The Financial Times exposed, I've now forgotten his name, but Christian, come on, help me here. They did it last year.
Can't remember. Yeah.
Okay. And I thought that's the first piece of investigative journalism I've seen for a long, long time.
Whereas there used to be the Sunday Times Insight team, didn't there?
And I started the Sunday Times Insight consumer unit, and the first thing we did was to get Wall sausages to stop putting a code on their sausages and actually give the date. And it's only in the last 6 months no one has to put the date on those sausages anymore.
And which columnist do you read in the papers?
Danny Finkelstein, Deborah Ross, Matthew Paris, anything Rachel Cook writes in The Observer.
Clarkson?
Yes, brilliant.
He's great, isn't he? Yeah.
And I mean, I don't know a more natural columnist than Clarkson.
Yeah, very relaxed.
And you don't know, as you know, and I know, that often the very relaxed style, it's really been hammered out slowly.
Jeremy Clark, the late Jeremy Clark, the Spectator, who I thought was brilliant, seems completely relaxed. It was agony for him. Yeah. And it's much easier to write in a convoluted, supposedly intellectual style, isn't it?
You know, most columns are too long. And I know what they're going to say. Danny Finkelstein's particularly good at original thought. There's not much original thought going on.
Yeah. And why do you think the papers have got worse like that? Is that because of the rise of me journalism? There are more egomaniac columns, aren't there, than there used to be?
It's the cheapest way to hire someone to give them a column. So a lot of people who shouldn't be near a computer have their own column, and you just think, I can't get past the second paragraph. The Observer once, obviously, in News Review, had no ideas that week, so they decided to ask people what ambitions they had left in their life, and I said to get to the end of a Melanie Phillips column.
Well, it's a very good place to stop. Thanks so much to Anne Robinson for appearing on the Oldie podcast.
Very enjoyable, thank you. Does someone edit that now?